Happy New Year to everyone. Today's episode of Lit with Charles is a little bit different than the usual. I'm not interviewing anyone. I just wanted to start this new year by going through the past year and highlighting the top five books that I had read last year and give you some of my top recommendations of 2023. And before we get into that, I might throw in a couple of honorary mentions of books that deserve praise but didn't quite make the top five. I'd like to give a quick shout out to the most innovative book that I read this year, which was a French graphic novel called La Couleur des Choses, which in English translates as The Color of Things. And it was written by a young Swiss graphic novelist called Martin Panchaud. And I interviewed him for this podcast. You can look up the episode if you're interested. And this was such a fascinating, innovative way of presenting a graphic novel. What he did was to replace characters with dots, and the entire perspective of the novel was really as seen from above and presented in a very technological, data-driven way that reflects our current society in so many ways. And the story was really an incredible plot with these lovely characters. It's a huge adventure. I thought there was something really Dickensian about it, but when I interviewed the author, he said he'd just been inspired by a stay that he'd done in England. So it had nothing to do with Dickens, but I think inadvertently, he really brought out a form of the 19th century novel of an orphan trying to find his way in the world. So a shout out to that book for being so innovative. I also want to give a shout out to a book of poetry that I really enjoyed this year by a young Scottish poet called Iona Lee. She wrote her first collection of poems called Anamnesis, and it's to do with memory, especially with memories of a previous existence. She's a young poet. She's just published this first collection, and I thought it was really fantastic. And I interviewed this poet for my podcast, and there was so much authenticity to her art that I was really impressed by. And she explained to me during the interview that she came really from more of a tradition of performative poetry in pubs. And I just thought that was so real and so cool that I want to give a quick shout out to that book today because I really enjoyed it. There were a lot of other fantastic books, each of them with some great characteristics or attributes or emotions, and I can't cite them all here. If you're interested in getting a better glimpse of all the books I read over the year, then you can refer to my Instagram account, @litwithcharles. But so without further ado, now that I've given a quick shout out to those two books, here are my top five of last year. In fifth place was a fantastic book from India called Desperately Seeking Shahrukh by Shrayana Bhattacharya. She's a development economist and a writer, and she wrote this book following some research projects that she was doing as a development economist for the World Bank in India across different regions, especially in rural, poorer regions of India. And she was examining the role of women in society, their function in the economic framework of India. And during that investigation, she started to notice that women that she was interviewing, they weren't really opening up all that much to her questions. She was asking questions from a clipboard. And these women that she was interviewing, they'd seen this 1,000 times before. They'd seen the development economists from the World Bank or from the UN before, and they'd answered all those questions. And frankly, they were a little bored of this. And so Shrayana Bhattacharya noticed this, and she started talking to them about something that she felt these women might prefer talking about, which was their favorite movie star. And she noticed that a lot of these women were huge fans of a Bollywood star called Shahrukh Khan, who is, for all intents and purposes, the biggest Bollywood star out there. Imagine if you combined Tom Cruise, George Clooney, and Brad Pitt into a single star and combined that star power into one person. That's the level of Shahrukh Khan. He's absolutely huge. But he's also unique in another way, which is that unlike other mega Bollywood stars, he's taken an approach in his film and career choices which reflects a more sensitive side of masculinity, a more egalitarian aspect of relationships between men and women. And so he's built a huge fan base of women who have developed higher aspirations for what they expect from their relationships with their partners and how they expect those partnerships to operate. So he's really, in this almost single-handed way, modernized a lot of the expectations of people in India and a lot of the ways that men tend to look at masculinity today. So he's had this incredible influence. And this book, Desperately Seeking Shahrukh, looks at how this influence has permeated India across all these different regions, different socioeconomic levels, and really had such an amazing impact. It's a series of vignettes across India, wealthier women, poorer women, but they each have a story. And I understand that a lot of people might look at this methodology as being rather unscientific. Of course, it's more anecdotal than scientific, but it delivers some real insights that I think are really valid. One often hears a lot of people talk about the real India. Oh, what's the real India? Where is the real India? What is it? And I think this book is probably about as close as a Westerner like myself might get to glimpsing the real India, to getting an understanding of the real India. And I love the way that it's done through this totally unconventional approach of blending this important highbrow subject like development economics and the role of women in society and how they interact with the economic structures of the country, and combine that with this very pop, lowbrow subject like a movie star and get some insights out of that blend. I thought that was really quite unique, very original, and very clever. And what's most important is the book is really readable and it really delivers some interesting conclusions about the power of this single individual over the transformation of this really important subject of femininity in India and conversely masculinity. So that's my fifth favorite book of the year. It was really a fascinating look at that country. In fourth place, we have a novel which was published about 10 years ago by Martin Amis, who was a writer. He died recently, was a leading contemporary British writer. He had a huge bibliography. He was the son of Kingsley Amis, also an incredible British novelist. And he always had a whiff of controversy around him. He always wrote about somewhat controversial, painful subjects. And this one is no exception because it's about the Holocaust. And specifically, it's about the day-to-day existence of a Nazi death camp commander who goes about his daily life in a sociopathically detached way, almost blissfully ignorant or morally ignorant of the killing machine that he has set up and is operating in Auschwitz, killing millions of people. And he's surrounded by a similarly deluded circle of Nazi officers, all of whom are pursuing their weird, bizarre, dark agendas, again, in a very detached, delusional way. There's one officer who's trying to pursue an affair with a woman at the camp, the wife of another commandant. So the whole thing is this utterly weird juxtaposition, this ultra high definition contrast between the banality of existence and this terrifying death camp, and these sociopaths going along trying to make the best of a clearly deteriorating situation. You get the sense that the war is not going the way of the Nazis, and they're all kind of like rats preparing to leave a sinking ship, but also ideologically aligned to delivering the mission of the Nazi regime and delivering the final solution that they have been asked to execute. So it's clearly a very dark book. It's very triggering subject matter. This is not a lighthearted book. It shouldn't be seen as that. There's a lot of grotesque elements to it. But nonetheless, that contrast between the psychopathic delusions of this group and the horror they're perpetrating, as well as the beautiful prose, straight to the point, very bureaucratic in the way that you might imagine a murderer like Adolf Eichmann to operate a camp like that. It really captures this vibe so well. And again, it's very cold, very metallic, but it's done in a very, very powerful way. And I really recommend it. What's interesting to note is that this book has now been adapted into a movie by Jonathan Glazer, who's one of my favorite directors of all time. He directed movies like Sexy Beast, Birth, Under the Skin. So he's got an incredible filmography behind him. And he's put his talents to adapting this book. And it was shown at the Cannes Film Festival this year, apparently to rave reviews. And it should be coming out in 2024. And I think if there's anybody I would trust to bring this completely bizarre tale of evil to the screen, it's probably this guy. So it'll be very interesting to watch out for that and see where exactly it goes and how exactly he delivers that book. Again, it should come with a trigger warning. This is not an easy book. This is a very traumatizing book in so many levels because it deals with such a painful, traumatic, tragic episode of human history. In third place is a novel that was written last year by the New Zealand writer Eleanor Catton. She's a young writer who, even 10 years ago, had won the Booker Prize for her massive novel, The Luminaries. That was like a 900-page novel on the colonization of New Zealand in the 19th century. And this book is a much more contemporary, much more snappy, shorter novel that's extremely readable in a way that the previous novel maybe wasn't. But what's incredible with this is it deals with very contemporary topics in a very direct way. And those topics are things like ecology, technology, inequality, issues that are of growing importance, of critical importance in our society today, and which lie at the fault line of maybe a generational and wealth divide. The novel pits a NGO composed of young, idealistic Gen Z young people who are focused on an ecological mission, and it pits them against this cynical tech billionaire from the US who's in New Zealand, seemingly under the pretense of the usual nonsense of building a bunker to protect himself from the apocalypse. But in fact, he may be delivering a more sinister objective. And so these two strange bedfellows are going to connect and try to interact in a way that examines the morality of achieving one's objectives. And what's great is that the characters, especially the young idealists, are at times morally conflicted, they're ambiguous, they drive their agendas in different ways according to the different people. And this is really, I think, a great reflection of our society today. And I think in that way, the novel is a really great reflection of a 19th century novel, let's say, like a Dickens novel that really hit the important social elements of that era's society, like child poverty, for example. This novel does that for our society, for our world. And I think it does it in a very powerful way that a lot of young people would identify with, the sort of moral conflicts that they have to come into to achieve or at least approach some achievement of their aims. It's very, very well done. At the heart, this is a thriller. So it's very readable, very enjoyable. This is not a tough read. If you've gone out of the reading habit and you're looking for something to get back into it, this is it. this is a really easy book to get into and lots of great characters and plot developments, and I really recommend it. It's great to see Eleanor Catton delivering something that is both very powerful, but also quite commercial and reader-friendly. So I recommend this, and I hope people enjoy it as much as I did. In second place is a very different novel because it's a classic Western written in the mid-80s, Lonesome Dove by Larry McMurtry. This was written in 1985. It won the Pulitzer Prize. It's 800 pages. It's absolutely massive. And yet, it's one of the most enjoyable books I've ever read. Let me just start by saying that I don't love Westerns. I find it a very cheesy genre. It's very black and white, good versus evil. There's something about the American destiny that I think irritates me somewhat. But this is done in a much more subtle, much more nuanced way. And it's at heart a story of characters. This is what really pops out of this book are the characters. They're just so amazingly drawn, so subtly drawn. Every character, all the way down to the less significant characters, they all have these very clear personalities and clear objectives, and they all work in these very credible ways. And at the heart of the novel are two characters who are kind of an odd couple, two old cowboys who are former Texas Rangers, who in their youth had been part of various struggles, various conflicts, whether against Mexican bandits or outlaws or indigenous tribes. And they're now older, they are probably a little bit over the hill, and they've decided to retire. And this retirement takes the form of running a small ranch outside a border town in Texas called Lonesome Dove. And they have a little posse of guys, and they lead a pretty peaceful existence. Until one day, one of their old compadres from the Texas Rangers shows up in town and dangles in front of them the possibility of starting a massive cattle drive across the U.S. from Texas to Montana, which borders Canada, to drive about 3,000 heads of cattle. And without much convincing, they decide to embark on this great adventure with their team. And on this journey, they're going to encounter a ton of obstacles, a ton of colorful characters, a ton of dark characters, killers and bandits. They're going to meet all sorts of challenges. They're going to rise to the challenges. They're going to fail in other challenges. They're going to lose friends. And again, the characters are what really drives this story in such an incredible way. And I have to say that when I read this, at one point, one of the major characters dies. In fact, a lot of characters die, but one of the major characters dies at one point. And I was crying. And I have to say, I don't cry very often in books, but this one really moved me because the character was so alive. He was just a part of my life while I was reading this book. And I really empathized with his situation, with his life, and with his tragic demise. So this is, again, a very long book. I know a lot of people are sometimes reluctant to embark on long books. There's something, an inbuilt fear in many of us that if a book's more than 300 pages, it's considered long. However, I would argue that if a book is fantastic, as this book is, then you sort of want the book to continue on forever. You don't want it to end. And this is one of those books. Even by the time you're on page 500, 600, you really want it to keep going. And the good news is that Larry McMurtry, the author of this book, created a whole series around Lonesome Dove. Some books are sequels to the stories, and some books are prequels to when the two older cowboys are young Texas Rangers and going through those adventures. So they're maybe worth checking out as well. I haven't read any of them. I've heard mixed messages on some of these books, but it's certainly, I think, a series that's worth checking out. And it's definitely epic in all senses of the word, from the characters, the adventures, the landscapes, the historical aspect of the real struggle of these characters and the adventures they go through. I can't recommend this enough. I had a blast reading it, and I think you will too, if you can stick to it and get through the 800 pages. And now finally, in first place, the book that I most appreciated this year, that I absolutely adored. I read it very early this year, probably in February, and already then I knew that this was going to be the best book I was going to read in 2023. And I'm talking about the novel, The Passenger by Cormac McCarthy, who sadly died a few months after this book was published. And he also published a companion novel, a much shorter companion novel, probably 100 pages, 150 page companion novel called Stella Maris, which is, I thought, a little bit weaker. And I think The Passenger can stand on its own and be talked about as a single book, even though it is connected to this companion novel. This is a really worthy swan song for Cormac McCarthy. Many of you know of his work. He has a very Hobbesian view of the world. What does that mean? It refers to the English philosopher from the 17th century, I think, Thomas Hobbes, who described the existence of human as nasty, brutish, and short. That was to say that we're basically all on our own, and we've got to fight it out, and it's a huge anarchy, and you best do what you've got to do to stay alive and survive and prosper. And this is very much Cormac McCarthy's worldview. And that's been illustrated in many of his books, like Blood Meridian, like The Road. These are tales of people struggling against terrible situations in states of appalling violence. There are brutal retributions for characters who step a little bit out of line or who aren't very careful. And so this is the world that Cormac McCarthy inhabits. This is not as brutal as his previous works, but there is an element of violence here in various ways. Maybe not gun violence like there might have been in the past, but there is violence. It's the story of a salvage diver who examines a plane that has sunken at the bottom of the sea in the Gulf of Mexico. He's based in New Orleans. He goes to see this plane with a partner, and very quickly, it seems that somebody else has been diving at this scene. They get a sense that something's gone off. And this opening is, in fact, a red herring for a book that's going to go in all sorts of different directions, especially given the biography of the main character, who is a former race car driver / nuclear physicist, now salvage diver. He's a real man's man. And this encounter with the plane at the bottom of the sea has maybe triggered some powers that be, or maybe it hasn't. Maybe it's all in his head. Maybe it's a function of the setting of New Orleans, a setting of heavy sweat and paranoia. But in any case, he is going to try and get away from this sense of pursuit that he's got coming after him, with regard, or maybe not with regard, to this plane. And again, this book touches on so many different topics that are, I think, of real passion to Cormac McCarthy. I think he was really passionate about physics, for example. He lived in Santa Fe. He was connected to the Santa Fe Institute, which is a deep research think tank of leading futurologists and physicists, and he enjoyed those kind of conversations. And so in this book, he goes off on a tangent about nuclear physics. Does it drive the plot? No, not necessarily, but it sounds really cool, and it adds something to the character that is really fascinating. So he goes in all these directions, but at the heart of the novel, besides the paranoia, there are two other elements that are explored and very well done. The first is mental illness, and one of the characters in the book suffers from a form of paranoid schizophrenia, and this character has visions of the illness embodied by people, and these characters that embody the mental illness are presented in such a strong way that I got a much better understanding of what's involved in this illness, how it impacts the people who suffer from it. And it was just very empathetic. It felt like an author who really cared about this kind of suffering. And this illness is also brought on by or has some causation with a forbidden love between two of the characters. I don't want to go much deeper in this, but there's a forbidden love, a very taboo forbidden love. These star-crossed lovers who can never, ever connect, who should never, ever connect. And they are intersecting in ways that are sometimes difficult to fathom because, again, the novel zigs and zags in so many different places. But the love that is depicted is so strange and so unique that it overcomes those minor logistical difficulties in the book. I honestly thought that this was Cormac McCarthy at near the top of his powers. The prose, as always, is extremely clean. You get a sense, again, that this might have been his last book. He had a sense that this was his last book, maybe, because he really put in things that he was passionate about. I don't think he really cared whether there was any commercial aspect to it, that this would be recommended by the Oprah Winfrey Book Club or that this would be adapted into a Netflix thing. No, there was never any sense of that. He just wrote about what he wanted to write about. And that sensation, that passion of the author resonates while you're reading it. For me, it was blinding and really very enjoyable. I have to warn people, this is not a conventional book. If that's not clear from what I've just said, then I really should clarify it now. It's not a conventional book. It's a completely idiosyncratic book. It's unlike anything you've ever read before. And I think therein lies its power. There's some ambition, there's some risk-taking that the author wanted to share with us. Maybe that was a function of his presumably limited lifespan. I think he was 90 around the time he wrote it. But the energy that comes out of it, you just wonder, how on earth did a 90-year-old come up with this? Because the emotional energy in it must have been so draining to him to write this. I just couldn't fathom it. So that's my top book of 2023. I absolutely loved it. I might add that, yeah, the companion piece, Stella Maris, which looks at another character in the novel, I thought was much less strong, not only because of the character themselves, but also because of the structure of the book. It's more of a dialogue between that character and a doctor. So there's much less exploration of different themes and subjects and storytelling methods. It's much drier, a bit more rigid, and it doesn't really add much to the story. But The Passenger, I thought, was vintage Cormac McCarthy and well worthy of being ranked in his top novels. So those were my top five for the year, with a couple of honorary shout-outs at the beginning. I hope that these inspire some reading. I hope people who are listening to this will discover some element that piques their attention and gets them to pick up a book and read one of them. And I hope that they enjoy the book that I've recommended. And as always, I'm open for feedback or comments. I'd love to have a discussion with any of you listening. You can always contact me on my Instagram account @litwithcharles to get that discussion and that debate going. Thanks a lot. Bye.